Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As promised, this hour we'll talk about bioethics. One of the great gifts to the church is right here in the United States. It's the National Catholic Bioethics Center, and they produce all kinds of helpful materials and teaching and insights that the church needs at a time where it's just one battle after another, as far as and many of the battles are just intellectual battles, trying to figure out which things are ethical, which things are unethical, where are we treating human life and human dignity with proper respect, and where are we not? It gets harder and harder when you get things on the microscopic level, and you're reading monitors rather than the old-fashioned, you know, stethoscope on the chest. And so we have these very well-educated folks who help us think through these things. And among them, one of the greats, Father Tad Poholchik, is our guest this hour. So if you have a question about bioethics, about life in its earliest stages, life in its latest stages, maybe life in distress at any stage, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Father Tad Poholchik from the National Catholic Bioethics Center, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Good to be with you, Cy.
You know, a lot of people, Father, it's strange how things kind of come in waves, but more and more I'm getting emails from folks who want to know about organ donation and what constitutes death, because I guess this is being debated, and you actually recently debated this topic.
Yes, that's right. You know, it was an unusual thing in the sense that the Catholic Medical Association hasn't really held a formal debate on any topic in a few years. So there were some intrepid individuals who decided to put together a debate on the question of brain death and, you know, to ask whether this is something that is compatible with Catholic teaching. And so we had myself and a cardiologist against another philosopher and a cardiologist, and we were debating this question. And you know, the church has really been quite clear on this on many different levels. I always remind people that Pope John Paul II issued an important statement about brain death in the year 2000. And really, he said this doesn't raise fundamental conceptual problems. You know, there are issues, of course, that may relate to testing and whether you're checking carefully all the tests, all the signs that would indicate that somebody is actually brain dead and therefore dead. But if you do all of those tests and don't, you know, take any shortcuts, the Pope made it clear that by following these provisions of the medical field, one can achieve moral certainty about the fact that somebody has died. So when that's the case, then, you know, the next question becomes, oh, well, what about organ donation? Is it okay to donate my organs if, in fact, I am dead? And the church on that matter has been also very clear and said that as long as a person is not under coercion and they decide freely of their own will to make such a donation, and they are, in fact, deceased, then there is not a problem with donating their unpaired organs. And of course, if you have paired organs, like we all have two kidneys, it is possible, even before you die, to donate one of your two kidneys. You know, as long as doctors make the assessment that you could live well with just one kidney, that you don't seem to need both of them. So, you know, that's a special case. But when we're talking about cadaveric donation, then you do have to have died, and that can be determined, you know, either the traditional cardiopulmonary way where you stop breathing and your heart stops, or through brain death, which determines the complete loss of all functions of the brain.
Again, 888-318-7884 is our number. You are welcome to call. And by the way, you don't have to be Catholic to call. Catholics have a long tradition of thinking through bioethical questions, and if you'd just like to get the Catholic perspective, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Father, I think some of the debate comes around this idea that we were told that people, you know, were in what was called, and I know that this is very disrespectful language to living human beings, but this is the language people say they were in a vegetative state, and they can't, there's no brain activity. And we find out later that in many cases, this was a mistake. This was not true, that people could not communicate. They were locked in, so to speak, but they weren't in a vegetative state. So I think that leaves people uncomfortable with the ability of medical professionals to properly evaluate the condition of the brain.
Yes, I think that's a great observation. And I mean, what you're really getting at here is that there is a real and important difference between the vegetative state and being brain dead.
Okay.
When you're brain dead, you're dead.
Yeah.
When you are in the vegetative state, you are in a situation where you are non-responsive, largely, but you're not dead. If they actually do tests on your brain, they will find, you know, many reflex activities. They will find, you know, many other indications that your brain is functioning, but for reasons that are not always fully understood, you're not necessarily conscious, and you are often very limited or prevented from responding at all to kind of the environment around you. So those individuals can be, as you're saying, locked in a different, you know, situation, or limited in the way that they can communicate with people around them. But they're certainly not dead. I mean, they're not even close to dead. And so it's important to keep those differences in mind. When somebody is brain dead, you have a situation where all the functions of the brain have been irreversibly lost. And sometimes the way this happens is you will have a complete cessation of blood flow to your brain for a long period, you know, for half an hour. No blood goes into your brain at all. Your whole brain just dies. And there's nothing, you know, that it can do. It's just, that's not a recoverable state. When the entire organ has died. And that's just taken then as a suitable indicator of the death of that organism. That person is deceased and will not be coming back, no matter what science or medicine tries to do for them, versus the case of people who have some brain damage, like the individuals in the vegetative state, and sometimes it's pretty serious brain damage, but they still have other parts of their brain that are working, and they are not dead. They are not deceased.
Okay, and you have high confidence that at least, I mean, you can't, you know, the unethical person who, you know, the nurse or the doctor who will commit euthanasia, thinking that they're being helpful or something. You can't. There's. I'm not talking about that. But you're an ethical physician. Can make these calls, you have high confidence of that.
Yes, indeed. I mean, the kinds of criteria that have been developed by the American Academy of Neurology, they have issued a set of guidelines that are very stringent and, you know, very robust and reasonable guidelines. And those guidelines are used very widely, I would say, you know, in the entire United States, but also in a number of other countries as well. Some other countries have, you know, different sets of guidelines, but they don't differ in the kind of key types of assessments, which are, you know, first looking for any hints of reflexes that might be present from an individual who has suffered this catastrophic brain demise. And in the absence of that, you also check, very important to understand that if somebody is brain dead, they are always, always, always on a ventilator. They cannot breathe on their own. That is absolute impossibility because their brainstem, which is the part that, you know, triggers your breathing, has been destroyed, so they will never breathe on their own. And if you take them off the ventilator, they do not even try to take a gasp. They just lie there.
Because they're gone. Yeah, I see.
Yes. So these things, you know, are very definitive types of tests. If there's any ambiguity on some of the tests, then the American Academy of Neurology also has pointed out that physicians can use some extra tests. There are a few extra tests that actually use tracers, put them into the bloodstream, and you check, is there any blood going into the brain or not? Yeah. And if you get a no, then you, again, have further confirmation. This person already died some time ago, and, you know, we're just kind of stringing things out a little bit with the ventilator, but they are not living anymore as, you know, a complete human organism.
All right. Again, our number is 888-318-7884. There are a bunch of folks on the line. I'm glad to see it because I know there are many, many bioethics questions. We always like it when Father Tad is here to take your questions. We do have to take the first break, however, so we'll do that and then we'll come back. Right now, we've got a free ebook for you. Well, we always try to have a free ebook for you, but the one right now is called Mysteries and Miracles. You want to know about the Book of Enoch. Maybe you want to know about blood miracles, the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's a mystery, not so much a miracle. You can get it for free. Just head over to shop.catholic.com and pick up Mysteries and Miracles for free as an ebook right now.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious mystic monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All mystic monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase mystic monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Raymond Arroyo.
Part of the success we've had on the world over, I attribute to the audience, my relationship with Mother Angelica, and her teaching me that when you sit with someone, you talk to them, and you create an environment where they will tell you things they wouldn't tell anyone else. That ease, that humor, that warmth, she gave me that, and that's what I try to impart and make a part of every interview we do on the world over.
The World Over with Raymond Arroyo, Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern on EWTN-TV and radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Bioethics for a Monday afternoon, maybe a Monday evening where you are. Maybe you're getting up to the Philippines right now and having your coffee and a little bioethics for you with that coffee. Thank you for being here with us. We appreciate it. Father Tad Poholchik is our guest, both a scientist and a theologian and the director of education for the National Catholic Bioethics Center. Am I right? Your title hasn't changed.
That's correct. Okay. Yes, I'm still the director of education, and you know, we run a certification program every year, and we have roughly 80 students from around the country and from overseas who study with us to learn Catholic bioethics. So that's sort of my particular bailiwick, if you will.
Oh, that's great. But now, do you have to be a trained physician or scientist to do that, or is it open to others?
It's open, actually, to anybody who would be interested. And so, for example, we do get lawyers, we do get high school teachers who are trying to figure out, you know, how can I teach my students what the Church holds about in vitro fertilization? I don't really have, you know, the tools to be able to explain it to them.
Yeah.
Or, you know, others who are in pro-life work will take our program. Anybody who has an interest in bioethics, it's a great way to kind of get up to speed.
Lots of folks, as I said, on the line for you, Father. I'm going to go to Ryan in Atlanta, Georgia, listening on our app, the Catholic Answers app. We're glad to have you, Ryan. Go ahead with your question for Father Poholchik.
Hey, I've got one for Father Paul, but also one for you, maybe, if you have a second as well. But for the first one, if one creates, let's say, a truly sentient, self-aware computer program, is self-learning, like truly artificially intelligent, would one commit murder by deleting that program and be down the road to hell?
Yeah, okay. That's an interesting question, conceptual type of question, Ryan. And at the end of the day, when one talks about truly artificially intelligent, you know, that term is never going to be the same thing as the kind of intelligence that you and I have and exercise. Ours is nested in the reality of a free will, and it, when you set up a computer program or some kind of robot, you are dealing with a situation where it still is constrained very much by the limits of the one who programmed it, even if it does have the ability to acquire new information, alter its own algorithms to a certain degree. There still remain constraints on that, so that it's not a truly free kind of activity in the way that our choosing is genuinely free. So there's a fundamental difference here. And if you turn off, you know, if you flip the switch on the machine, I mean, you may be doing something wrong in the sense that some programmer may have poured out his, you know, his energies into making this thing work pretty efficiently, and now it's been lost if they didn't save the code for him. So that would be bad. But I mean, is it some kind of sin in the way that killing a human being is? Absolutely not. The two are not on the same plane at all. So I hope that is kind of the gist of what you're asking here, and I hope that's helpful.
Ryan?
Yeah, I suppose so. I guess I was going on the assumption that it was self-learning and was truly sentient as much as a human mind. But you know what Dreyfus and Dreyfus said, that such a thing would always be impossible because computers would always run code. So we'll go with that.
Ryan,
go ahead.
Go ahead, Ryan. Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
I'm going to accept his answer. I listened to a previous show with you speaking about Darwinian evolution and the construct of life, you know, basically self-forming over, I guess, eons of time. And I was just curious, are you aware of John Sanford, Dr. John Sanford? He's a Cornell geneticist. He wrote the book Genetic Entropy. Are you aware with any of that?
I don't. Father might be. I don't think I am, Ryan. I it's not ringing a bell. Father, are you familiar with Dr. Sanford's work?
No, that one doesn't ring a bell with me either.
Is there a particular thing in there that you want us to attend to, Ryan?
Well, you know, I don't know. I'm going to send you something. There's a lot of compelling arguments against the idea that life could ever self-form, according to the information theories put out by Dr. Warren Gitt, Dr. Sanford, and Dr. Warren Brown, Dr. Ann Gauger, Dr. Douglas Axe, and Dr. Mike Behe, and those shows, no one ever called in and actually brought the opposing view. So
of all of them that you mentioned, Dr. Behe is the only one that I'm familiar with, and I actually remember reading an article by him about information theory and genetics and an argument that you couldn't get information. You can't get information encoded unless there's someone who encodes it. And that might be where you're going, but I'd love to read it. And I hope you will send all of that to me. You can always, the easiest one is radio@catholic.com. The easiest email address is radio@catholic.com. And if you'd like my personal email address, just shoot an email there. It's just longer, that's all. But I'm happy to give it to you. Ryan, I'm going to say thanks and keep moving because every single line is full. And I want to get everybody on with Father Poholchik. Let's go to Newport Beach, California. Aaron, listening to EWTN, Channel 130 on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Aaron, go ahead with your question for Father.
Hi, Father.
I
had a situation when my husband was 46 years old and I was 43 years old. This was 20 years ago. And my husband had a brain aneurysm one day. And the next day, you know, I was so young, I didn't know what that meant. When we went to the hospital, I was thinking, okay, well, he had a brain aneurysm. Okay, so, well, what are you going to do? I mean, what are we going to do? I wasn't thinking dying. So I kind of had to get up to speed, like, okay, this isn't going to really work out. So the neurologist came in, and he proposed that we go in and kind of see if we could clean up the blood in the back of his brain and see if that would make a difference. And, you know, I didn't even know what a brain aneurysm was. So when it was all said and done, you know, those things that you just explained about the doctors coming in where they try to see if you have any responses at all, and there were no responses. So the surgery didn't bring out any good outcome. And so then they told me, well, he was on a ventilator and he was brain dead. And so now my brother-in-law comes in and says, well, you know, we should consider donating organs. And so I thought, oh, okay. So we donated some of the veins that go to the heart and a liver and kidney, and I thought it was the right thing to do at the time, but then when I got older, I started thinking about it, and I was wondering if it really was the right thing to do, and what would the church, we were both Catholics.
Well, let's let Father...
I just didn't know how to discern the matter at the time.
Yeah, did you handle this right? Okay, Father.
Yeah, I mean, Aaron, I think, you know, based on what you're describing, there is reasonable likelihood that, you know, he, in fact, had died. I mean, brain aneurysms can present in different ways, but certainly you can have a brain aneurysm that is large enough and enough bleeding and enough pressure then inside the skull that, you know, the brain will kind of even end up herniating and not, you know, continuing to be perfused, and the brain will die. And if those tests were done, you know, I think the question you're asking is, well, we had good reasons to believe he had died. Is there a problem with donating his organs? And there isn't. There isn't, in the sense that you were doing it first out of a good intention to provide help to others. And I think you had a sense that he probably would have done the same thing, and maybe you even had an explicit conversation with him where he indicated that. So, you know, you were the person now who became the proxy making decisions on his behalf, and so you had the rightful authority to make that determination, you know, as best you could. So I don't see any fundamental problem in what you're describing. I mean, the fact that a liver and some of the veins leading to the heart were used to help other people, I think that was a, you know, generous decision, given that he had died and he didn't need, of course, those organs any further. So, I mean, the Church has emphasized, and Pope John Paul II in particular, that the decision to donate your organs is a generous one. You're not required to do it, but if you decide to do it freely, that's recognized as a generous decision on your part. So I hope that's helpful. I mean, the discernment around this is always related to, you know, what would the person want to do, and what is the actual status, you know, of their existence. Have they died? And once they have, then organ donation is a sensible and certainly allowable decision on the part of the family.
Does that ease your mind, Aaron?
Yes, so much. You have no idea.
Oh, really. Praise God. Thank God for that, Aaron.
Yeah, it just really eases my mind so much, because I prayed about it, and of course, as you get older and you mature and you wonder, and yes, we did have some of those conversations maybe through the years, but
okay.
I really appreciate your comments. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Aaron.
Well, you're very welcome.
Yeah, and thank you for calling. I am going to keep moving. I think we can get more in before we have to take another break, and we have lots of folks on the line, so I'm going to go to Barbara in Louisiana listening on the TuneIn radio app. Barbara, go ahead with your question for Father Tad Boholczyk.
Well, good evening, Father. Thank you for taking my call. Very much like Aaron, I think we made the right decision, but about 20 years ago, my mother, who had was basically bedridden, she'd been ill for several years. She was on oxygen and a feeding tube, had serious dementia, and then she suffered a major stroke to the brain, to the base of the brain. So when we ended up in the emergency room and they're asking us to make decisions whether to intubate her, we didn't even know what that was. We didn't know what to do. And in the end, we decided not to. They told us if they did that, I guess that's basically placing someone on a ventilator, that she might have a couple of weeks. They couldn't, you know, tell us exactly how long. And it was a really difficult time to make that decision, but we decided not to go forward with that. And I'm just wondering if you can contribute anything for us. Of course, she didn't know us. She didn't have any responses as far as for living, you know, life like where she would have known or been able to contribute anything
Barbara.
To a decision.
Let's let Father answer, because there's just a few seconds left. Father, did you want to respond to Barbara?
Yes. So I think the basic question she's asking is whether this involves an extraordinary means to perhaps put her mom onto the ventilator, and it very well could be. In other words, it's not a minor decision to go on to a ventilator, and especially if it looks like the benefits are going to be very low, very few benefits from doing that, then we could say, oh, ventilation has become heroic or disproportionate. And the church would say, when that's the case, when it's extraordinary, it's not required. You can choose to decline it. On the other hand, you know, if you had a young person and you were thinking about doing this, they might benefit significantly, and the calculus would be different.
Barbara, God bless you. Thank you very much for the call and for the question. We're talking bioethics with Father Tad Poholchik. At the moment, there is one line open, and if you'd like to ask a question, 888-318-7884.
This is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Thank you for listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Most of us Catholic parents agree our number one goal in life is to pass on the faith to our children. But here's the bad news. Today's world has a million ways to steal your kid's soul. Don't be afraid, says Father Sebastian Walsh. God loves your children even more than you do, and he desires their salvation more than anything. In his groundbreaking new book, Always a Catholic, Father Walsh shows you how to cooperate with God to bring about the fulfillment of his will for your kids. Always a Catholic reminds us that keeping our kids in the faith is about the way we live our Catholicism in our own lives and as a family from day to day. Order your copy of Always a Catholic by visiting shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Tomorrow on More to Life, resentment.
Is resentment poisoning your relationships? We'll help you find healing.
That's tomorrow on More to Life. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Keller, your host. Father Tad Poholchik is our guest. He's the Director of Education at the National Catholic Bioethics Center. National Catholic Bioethics Center is one of the premier places for thinking through the difficult bioethical questions of our time. Folks from all over the world make use of it. It's in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, one of the two best things that ever came out of Philadelphia. You have any idea what the other one is, Father?
You know, Cy, this probably could go in a lot of directions. Why don't you enlighten us?
I was born in Philadelphia, Father.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That's where I was going.
That's a slam dunk then.
Yeah, slam dunk, right. But lots of folks on the line, so I will stop goofing around, and we'll go to Luke now in Holson, Missouri, listening on Divine Mercy Radio. Luke, go ahead with your question for Father Tad Poholchik.
Hi, guys.
Can you
hear me all right?
Yes.
Right on. Thanks for taking my call. So my question is about the ethical nature or lack thereof of the practice of yoga as Catholics. The background question that I gave to your call screener was that what I've come to understand from the Vatican's chief exorcist a couple years ago was that more likely than not, as we understand it as Catholics, the poses, the yoga poses are rooted in worship of the demonic, that perhaps demons appear to primitive people in India like they may have in ancient Egypt. Like with Ra and things that said, you know, go ahead and contort your body in weird ways and worship me. And people did it because they, you know, showed them fantastic signs or wonders you know, to get them to do it. And I was just hoping you guys could comment on the practice of yoga from a Catholic perspective.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think this question is, it's important to make some distinctions, really, here. You know, one is that a lot of times yoga is, in fact, associated with certain philosophical or spiritual beliefs and systems. And so it kind of, you know, presents itself as a package deal, that if you're going to do yoga, it means you're sort of buying into these systems and philosophies that are problematic and that that raise their own set of concerns. But it's not always that way. In other words, if your interest here is you're just somebody who's looking to do some exercises and to do some stretches, and you have, you know, no interest in kind of the religious or philosophical backgrounds or other connections here. For example, yoga sometimes, you know, has connections to something called Reiki, which, you know, has very significant concerns that it raises about spirituality. But if you're staying away from all that and you're just saying, no, all I'm interested in doing is, you know, getting stretched before I then go and do some other exercises, you know, maybe running around the track, there's not a problem with that. That is not per se, just because you're stretching and maybe, you know, some of those stretches have been sort of standardized by yoga, that doesn't raise a problem in and of itself. And, you know, I often point out to people that just because something comes maybe even from sort of pagan practices in the past, sometimes the church just baptizes those pagan practices and, you know, lifts up in a new direction. So I would say there's the possibility for that as well, in the sense that, you know, the church would say we should be responsible stewards of the gift of life that we've received, and that means we should eat well, do exercise, and, you know, there may be some of that that will look a little bit like the yoga but won't be part of the yoga spirituality. So not a fundamental problem unless you step into that philosophy and kind of religion slash spirituality that oftentimes is connected to yoga. That's where the concern arises.
Excuse me, I beg your pardon. Luke, thank you very much for the question. I hope that that was helpful to you. As I said, lots and lots of folks on the line with their bioethics questions for Father Tad Poholchik. I'm just going to let the call screener know I'm going to line six right now. Let's go to Todd in, I'm going to say, Mahal, Nebraska. I'm going to go with Mahal. I don't know how to pronounce that town name. So I'm going to say Mahal, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio, because if you're in Nebraska, you're probably listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. Todd, thank you very, very much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Father.
Yeah, thanks. Just put an O in front of that. Yes, thanks, brother, for taking my call. And Father, I had an experience with my stepdad who passed away as a result of oxygen not going to his brain, and he was cleared brain dead, and I kind of like wondered about like if he was really dead. But you made a statement like when a person does expire after they remove the breathing machine, that there's no response. I beg to differ with you. It was like he was alive. He took deep breaths, and he stood up and opened his eyes.
Well, if he was not tested formally for whether his breathing had stopped, then he would not be declared brain dead. So he may have had a lot of injury to his brain because, as you were saying, the oxygen, he had a deprivation or a loss of oxygen to his brain, and so he had some damage. But if he was able to breathe on his own without the help of the ventilator, then you can say for sure that he was not deceased. He was still alive. So that's and any doctor that, you know, will tell you that as well. He was not dead. He may have had very serious brain injuries, but he was not yet deceased.
I'm going to leave that there, Todd. It's very interesting to me, Father, and this happens often when we do any kind of pro-life or bioethics show. We get on one topic, and then It becomes the theme of that hour. So I just want to remind callers that when we're talking about bioethics, it's a vast field. And if your question is not about death, maybe it's about the beginnings of life. Maybe it's about how we can treat instances of physical disabilities or illness or what drugs, medicines we can take, all that. It all falls under the category of bioethics, including things that like are happening in laboratories nowadays, experiments being done on embryonic human beings and the like. So the full panoply of bioethics questions is available to you. You are welcome to call if you have a question on how to treat human beings, in whether in the earliest stages, the latest stages, or anytime in the middle stages of life. You're welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Once again, I want to remind you, we're having that store-wide sale, hundreds of great deals that you can shop at shop.catholic.com. Everything's on sale, at least 10 to 25% off. Some of this stuff is on sale up to 50% off. Go ahead over to shop.catholic.com and get your deals today.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
A brand new item at EWTNRC.com this month is the National Life Rosary with Italian wood beads. Designed exclusively for EWTN by premier Italian rosary maker Ghirelli in collaboration with renowned Catholic sculptor Timothy Schmalz. Help build a culture of life with the National Life Rosary with Italian wood beads. To order, go to EWTNRC.com and search for item number 78007.
Do you want to end abortion? Halt the attack on traditional marriage? And ensure religious freedom for ourselves and for our grandchildren? To do this, we must convert the culture. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a grassroots initiative that recognizes this need and takes it to the streets. If you're interested in peacefully sharing the gospel in your area, visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest is Father Tad Boholczyk from the National Catholic Bioethics Center, and we're talking bioethics this hour. A pressing need for more conversation about bioethics, I would say, because, Father, it just seems like there's the value of having these conversations with someone who has your education, for example, or others who are similarly educated is that, first of all, there's a very well-developed moral teaching of the Catholic Church, and it has many subtleties to it. It's not just a blunt instrument. It has subtleties to it. And then we have this very advanced science being done now. And so you have to apply this subtle and very well thought out, 2000 or even more, if you consider the history of ethical thought even before the coming of Christ. So we are applying this very subtle teaching on morals to this very subtle science. It sometimes just seems daunting.
Well, I think that's true. And, there's work that's going on that I think really does require the kind of careful thinking that you're describing. I mean, for example, I was looking at a paper the other day about scientists making what look like embryos using stem cells, and there's some question, are they actually embryos or not? And, there's some detail there, and as you're pointing out, there's nuance that necessarily informs a discussion like that. You're going to have to know the specific details of exactly how those embryos or pseudo-embryos were being produced and what they're capable of doing. So, those types of questions, the Church has been in the thick of it. I always point out to people that the Church had already thought about human cloning and about cloning in general way before Dolly the sheep was ever cloned.
Yeah.
So the Church does stay ahead of the curve, even though sometimes people accuse the Church of being behind. it's really a blessing to have the authority of the church reflecting on these very important and, you know, very potentially complex types of questions in the sciences.
I feel like that it's important for the church to do it too, because among professional, say, hospital ethicists or whatnot, in many cases, the reason that the person has the job as the professional ethicist is because they're willing to put up with things like abortion that we would not, that there's a kind of permissiveness that's almost required of the professional ethicist in some places.
Yeah, I'm afraid that sometimes that is true. And I always, you know, shudder when I run into cases like that. I don't run into it that often, but every so often you do. And at the same breath, I would say there are a number of ethicists who really are trying to follow faithfully the church and the Lord in their work for a Catholic hospital. So there is a little bit of variability. And, you know, sometimes the other piece of this is, I think there's a matter of kind of credibility and trust within the whole medical field itself. I mean, just to give you an example, I was dealing with a case not that long ago that basically she went to her doctor, and believe it or not, it was a kind of gynecological visit. The doctor was hitting on the patient. And you say to yourself, well, gee, that seems like such an obvious transgression of professional boundaries.
Right.
And yet, you know, that's an area that Hippocrates, who was a Greek physician, who was pre-Christian, had already said, look, doctors hold a privileged position, and they cannot be currying sexual favor with the people whom they are dealing with, because there's a special imbalance in the relationship. There's a special vulnerability that the patient has when they come to the physician. So, you know, you say to yourself, well, this isn't even a Christian conclusion,
right?
And yet we still have doctors in the field occasionally who are violating these just human norms and, you know, wreaking havoc and lowering the level of trust that we all definitely need when it comes to the medical profession. And this is why, you know, it's so wonderful to have groups, for example, like the Catholic Medical Association. You know, we started out with them at the top of the hour in that debate that I did in Orlando a few days ago. That group does really stellar work in bringing Catholic doctors together and finding solidarity among them, supporting each other, and educating them as well, you know, on a whole range of important issues for their practice as physicians.
That is wonderful to know. These institutions that have grown up within the Catholic Church, very, very helpful in that regard. We're going to head to Eugene, Oregon now. We'll go to Teresa, who's watching on YouTube. Teresa, thanks for joining us. Go ahead with your question for Father Tad Poholchik.
Yes, I was wondering if there's any ethical concerns with taking a pneumonia vaccine or a shingles vaccine, mostly a pneumonia, you know, and with what was going on with COVID, my concerns with aborted fetal cells and the production or testing of these vaccines.
Yes, Teresa. So let me answer the second one first, the shingles vaccine. The shingles vaccine was reformulated, and the typical shingles vaccine that's out there now doesn't have the problem that it used to. It used to be made in a way that relied on cell lines derived from abortions. You ask about the pneumonia treatment. That one I don't recall off the top of my head, but there is a website. It's called Children of God for Life, and they have a chart that you can check on, and it lists what the pneumonia one there, and I just don't remember off the top of my head whether that used the fetal cell lines for its production or not.
Thank you.
Okay.
You're welcome.
Thank you. So is there somewhere you can go, it's kind of a clearinghouse on this, that would tell you which vaccines are morally compromised, or is that just got to do the research?
Yes, there's really two good sources. I mean, one of them I just mentioned, which is the Children of God for Life. I think it's cogforlife.org or .com. But if you put in Children of God for Life into the search engine, it'll definitely take you there. And the other one is the Charlotte Lozier Institute.
Okay.
And they have both done some very good work. And the Charlotte Lozier Institute, in particular, has tabulated all the COVID vaccines very, very thoroughly, and exactly how they're related or not related, either during manufacture or during testing, to cell lines derived from abortions.
Teresa, again, thank you very much for the question. I'm going to go down now to Dallas, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Juanita in Dallas, go ahead with your question for Father Tad Boholczyk.
So it's actually two questions. My first question is, I'm a medical provider, and I had a patient come the other day, and his wife is also a patient, and I knew she was out of town for an extended period of time. And he came in asking for Cialis, which is for erectile dysfunction. And I happened to say, oh, you're visiting your wife. Have a nice trip. And he says, no, it's not for my wife. It's for my mistress. And I didn't know what to do because I knew this is wrong. But I ended up prescribing the tablet. I did a small prescription,
yeah,
but I did do it.
Okay, well,
and
that's
I don't
a very
know if that
question.
Was wrong or right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're correct in your sense that there is a problem of what we call cooperation in evil. And to the extent that you had clear knowledge that the purpose for which the Cialis was being prescribed was to use it outside of marriage, then there is a legitimate moral concern, and a provider should not make available a substance when you know that, erectile dysfunction kind of medication, when you know with certainty that it's going to be used in that manner. So there is a concern there, and I would say that when a physician runs into something like that, then it would be a moment to say something like, I understand why you may be asking for this, but I am not in a position to be able to provide Cialis to you because of what you shared with me here. This is not a proper direction for me as a provider. I provide these things for situations when there is erectile dysfunction and when the sexuality is being used in the way that it was designed to be used, which is always in marriage, in the setting of marriage. Anytime we engage our sexuality outside of marriage, there's a problem, and I can't cooperate with you making a decision to do it in this way just because you revealed it to me. If he had not revealed it to you and you didn't know what the use was going to be, I mean, and you had fair grounds to assume that he was going to use it with his wife, then of course there would not be a problem with prescribing it. But it's only in that case where you're quite sure, morally certain that it is going to be misused, that then one must step away from cooperating, because what you're doing is you're providing a kind of important contribution so that the evil action of adultery can be carried out more easily, more readily by the individual who is requesting the medication. So, I hope that's helpful. These are sometimes very difficult moments to make a quick assessment and decision, but it's good to think about them ahead of time as well. You know, when something similar comes up, if a pharmacist is asked to prescribe and to fulfill a prescription for birth control when he knows that it is specifically going to be used as contraception. Sometimes, of course, a birth control pill may be used for other valid purposes, like regulating periods when, there's heavy bleeding and things like that. But when you know for sure that this is why it's being prescribed, then it becomes important to take some kind of an appropriate step to build in some distance. And so a pharmacist, might say something like, I'm returning your prescription to you. I can't myself fill this for you. There may be somebody else here or in another pharmacy who can, but I am not able to do that out of conscience concerns. And they, you know, then the individual will have to start a new path and try to find somebody else to fill their prescription, and then you have stepped out of the chain or link to the commission of the evil act. So I hope that's helpful.
Is
that Juanita?
So I have to go to confession, basically.
Well, I mean, to the extent that you knew this, yes, if you knew it with clarity at that point, then I would say it's a good thing
and
to bring
to
confession.
I doubt it.
You kind of got caught off guard, huh, Juanita?
Yeah, maybe caught off guard. And I mean, if you really didn't know and didn't have time to process, then the guilt is less. But I always say to people, bring it to confession. Let, you know, clear the decks with the Lord Jesus. His mercy is overwhelming. He wants us to learn, and he wants us to love ever more and more. So confession is just, it's an awesome opportunity, you know, to set things right and then go forward and improve your work as a medical provider, even to a higher standard.
You had another one, Juanita. Did you want to share that with us? Or?
Yeah, so there's a patient in our clinic that I regularly see. She is brain dead from, she has been like that from birth. Apparently, was a problem when she was born, but she is in her early 20s, and her parents finally put her in an institutional setting. And so they brought her to me because they were worried if she ever get raped, if she'd get pregnant, could I give her birth control? And so my thought around it is right there, very small.
Juanita, go ahead. It seemed like we're losing you a little bit. But I think we have the question, Juanita, and this one seems a bit more complex, actually, but maybe Father will correct me on that. But it sounds like this is a young woman who's in an unconscious state, has been unconscious since birth. Her parents are going to put her in an institution, want her to have birth control because of the possibility that she would be raped and become pregnant. What's the status of prescribing birth control in that situation, Father?
Well, I think this kind of situation, parents will be motivated by the best of intentions. They're thinking, gee, we don't want a pregnancy to happen. And this seems like, oh, well, maybe this is a way of protecting, you know, from that outcome. But there's actually another side here, which I think people don't think about very carefully, which is if you put a young woman, and, you know, maybe she is unconscious mostly, or, you know, not in possession of her faculties, and maybe she's still reasonably attractive, and word gets out that she has been put onto contraception, what does that do? It, in a sense, heightens the profile, if you will, of her as a target for sexual abuse. And that's not what you want in an institutional setting. Also, there may be a temptation to say, well, as long as we give her contraception, then we really don't have to protect her quite as carefully as we would if we did not give her contraception. So we can neglect her a little bit. And again, that's not what a good institution should be doing when they are entrusted with the care and protection of very, very vulnerable individuals like this one. So in general, I counsel strongly against providing birth control in these circumstances. It does not achieve what it's proposed to achieve, and that we should be using much more appropriate types of steps to assure that there aren't pregnancies, because we're making sure that there isn't sexual activity in those institutional settings, and that individuals are receiving the proper vigilance that they deserve.
Father, that's an angle I would never have thought of, absent you saying it. Juanita, I hope that was helpful to you. I'm so grateful for your call. Very, very helpful questions. Thanks to everybody who called. I realize we didn't get to everyone, and I apologize for that, but we will have Father Tad on again. Father Tad Poholchik from the National Catholic Bioethics Center. I want to say thank you and ask you for your blessing before we go.
Absolutely. And let me just mention my website in case people are interested. It's fathertad.com. And I will be glad to give the blessing. May Almighty God bless you all in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen. Fathertad.com. Thanks, Father Tad.
Thank you so much, Cy. Great to be with you.